I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jeff Lang. He's author of the new book, Bud Fowler, Baseball's First Black Professional. He will be speaking at Collected Works Thursday night at 6 in the evening. That's tomorrow evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
And you'll also be speaking at the Santa Fe chapter of the NAACP on Tuesday night, the 8th of October at 7 o'clock, and that's at St. Bede's Church here in Santa Fe on San Mateo. Now, this is a very interesting story. It's a story of a man named Bud Fowler, whom I'd never heard of, who played baseball very well. He was an incredibly talented African-American man in the late 19th, early 20th century. And it's also the story of racism in America and the story of baseball itself. How did you come across this character, Bud Fowler?
Well, I was an English teacher for 40 years. But I was always, I've been a baseball fan since I was 6 years of age, and my father took me to Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, and I had a chance to see the Dodgers in the last year before they broke my heart and moved to Los Angeles. And I was particularly intrigued in how baseball became the national pastime, and became the national pastime rather quickly, meaning that the rules were somewhat established by about 1860, and all of a sudden, within a period of a decade or a decade and a half, it was the national pastime. And I was particularly intrigued by the name Bud Fowler because he would appear in a lot of histories, or people would assume that one knew a little bit about Bud Fowler, but the whole story really wasn't put together. And I had an opportunity, I have to thank the Society of American Baseball Research for giving me a small grant that I started out by studying the fact that Bud Fowler appeared here in Santa Fe, and he helped the Santa Fe Ancients in 1888.
What a name for a team.
Well, the Ancient City.
I know. But
yeah, and the Ancients, as far as I can tell, are the only professional team sports champion in the over 400-year history of Santa Fe itself. And so not only did Bud Fowler integrate the New Mexico Baseball League, but he led Santa Fe to its only championship in the only year of the existence of the New Mexico Baseball League. So that was my starting point. And it was an exercise in a kind of wow research. I would be led from one particular fact to another till I realized that here's a man who has played baseball at a high level for close to 20 years, and not only has he done that, but he has been an advocate of black entrepreneurial, you know, baseball as a business for a 30-year period, and his story had to be told. I mean, a delicious fact about him was that he wasn't born there, but he grew up in Cooperstown, New York.
Right.
And only recently some young scholars discovered that his father's barbershop was on Main Street, three blocks down from where the Baseball Hall of Fame is now, and directly across the street from Abner Doubleday Field, which is the kind of heart of Cooperstown itself. So with that as a kind of a starting point, I went out and discovered that this man deserves to not be mentioned in a footnote, but he deserves to walk into the Hall of Fame through the front door.
Bud Fowler was born in 1858.
Correct.
And the period right after the Civil War became a real burgeoning period for baseball. Not only did it become, as you said, the national pastime, it also became much more of a commercial sport. And unfortunately, I mean, at first, right after the Civil War, there was a lot of integration in all parts of society, and then the color lines became very solid and very hard to break through, and baseball became, like everything else in America, very segregated.
Correct.
What happened? Describe that period for us.
Well, the Civil War was both good and bad for baseball. Obviously, it reduced the number of teams and players in the East and the Midwest where baseball was already established. However, during the Civil War, the soldiers actually brought the sport to the South and helped to bring the sport to the Western territories. of which New Mexico itself was a part at the time. The idea was that baseball was supposed to be a kid's game. It was supposed to be a leisure sport. It started out not in the field of Dreams Smith. It didn't start, you know, with young boys playing in Sylvan Fields. It was a middle-class sport in big cities, especially New York, where clerks and people who worked on Wall Street would be done by 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and they'd get together socially, and the idea was this was part of the whole era of the development of physical culture, so they decided that they wanted to do something physical, and that baseball evolved from that particular notion, and that it quickly became a professional sport. By 1869, there was the Cincinnati Red Stockings were the first professional baseball team in which every player received a salary. I think, you know, they toured the whole country. They were undefeated except for one tie that year. And I think they made about $5. So that they quickly dissolved, the middle of the following year. But there's always been this tension in baseball, is that it should be a social event. It should be something positive. It should be something above professionalism. However, as soon as the sport developed and became popular, then money was involved, if not directly, you know, through salaries, through perks, and through other incentives. Once the money came in, gambling came in, and that gambling was an acceptable activity, but it certainly was not what the guardians of baseball actually wanted. And so by 1871, within a period of about 10 years, only 2 years after the actual development of baseball as a professional sport, you had the National Association of Professional Baseball Players in 1871. There was a split between the bulk of teams that remained amateur and wanted to remain amateur, you know, and the idea of baseball as a recurring myth and something positive and so on. And then there were 10 teams that developed a professional league, and that was all about money. That was all about success and so on. So I was attracted to the notion that baseball developed, but it always had this sort of inner tension, you know, between the advocates of, the sport as pure physical fun entertainment, and those people who saw it as a business. And the business end won out. You know, once money became involved, it was the death knell, really, for the amateur view. Although we still hold on to that notion, I think, today. You know, we see it in columns in the New Mexican, like the Anti-Fan, where Jim Gordon talks about the way sport should be in the actuality of it itself. That has always been the case from its inception.
And meanwhile, there were white leagues and so-called colored leagues.
Right.
How did they work?
Well, the colored leagues really weren't established per se. All baseball was, after the National Association in 1871, that lasted to 1875. The National League, the very same National League that exists today, was founded in 1876. There was another league founded the next year that was called the International Association. They were never quite the level of a major league, but they were the equivalent of a AAA team, you know, the highest of the minor leagues. They would be the equivalent to the league that the Albuquerque Isotopes play in now. So they were just one step below that particular level. Now, there were no rules. In fact, there have never been any rules that have prevented African Americans from playing in baseball, nothing written per se. But in 1878, through a fortuitous set of circumstances where Bud Fowler actually had an opportunity to pitch an exhibition game against the world champion Boston, I think they were called the Red Caps at that day, they defeated the championship. That would be like a rookie league team who had never played together, got together and defeated, you know, the reigning World Series champions. Now, the fact was that the Boston Red Caps didn't take the game awfully seriously. The game only lasted 95 minutes. Everybody was playing like their hair was on fire and they had a train to catch, which might literally have been the case. But Bud Fowler won the game 2-1. He became a sensation around the Boston area. And that soon afterwards, in 1878, this was a completely, you know, it was a white league. But he integrated that league and he became the first person to play, you know, minor league baseball in 1878, because the Lynn Live Oak team, which was near Boston, they had a player who apparently was under the weather. Now, that was a reporting journalistic euphemism for he was drunk and he was unable to perform. And so they said, we need a pitcher, you know, the next day. So they went and, you know, found Bud Fowler. Bud Fowler pitched in one particular game against the reigning champions, the London, Ontario Tecumsehs from Ontario, and he was winning 2-0. The other team created a fracas. They started, the 19th century term was kicking and complaining, and they demanded a new umpire. They didn't want to have an African-American defeat them on the field, so they forfeited the game. But it was clear that Bud Fowler was on his way.
Now, he was an amazing pitcher. He was a hitter.
Right.
He was also an entrepreneur, a manager, an organizer, a leader. He was really a almost larger-than-life person. It would have been wonderful to meet the man.
Absolutely. And his life was totally focused on playing baseball. I mean, not only did he integrate, you know, the minor leagues, he played twice as long as any other African-American player before the Negro Leagues were established in 1920. But he was successful, as you say, as a player. He became the first what was called co-captain of a team. That was actually what the manager would do today. He did the strategy, he did the coaching, he made out the batting order, he gave the signs, and so on. The term manager in the 19th century was more like the general manager and traveling secretary. They dealt with the money matters and the logistics of it. But he, you know, he co-captained the Montpelier Vermonts in 1887, and he was the most popular player on the team, you know. In 1895, for the Page Fence Giants, he had the first great touring all-black barnstorming team, I think would be the term that we'd probably use today. And what he would do is he would take his team with him, and he traveled first class. He made sure he had the financial backing. He didn't want his players, who were the best African-American players in the country, to be treated to, you know, refusals at the dining table, or, you know, to have, you know, lodging problems or difficulties. So he got this railroad car in which there was a cook and there was a cleaner for him, and they traveled in first class, and they so he brought a sense of dignity, and he brought a sense of perseverance, and he brought a sense of, if I'm not going to have an opportunity to play at the highest level of baseball that I could play at, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the best African-American team that I can have, and people will respect us and come and see us play for that reason. And that lasted for years and years. The Page Fence Giants went under fairly quickly, but he established his own Bud Fowler team. He called it the All-American Black Tourists. And there were literally 10 or 15 different incarnations of that name, and he would play wherever there was legitimate opposition, you know, for the next 15 years.
We're talking to Jeff Lang about his book, Bud Fowler, Baseball's First Black Professional. One of the things that I got from your book was that part of, I mean, there's such a nasty persistence and viciousness to racism in the United States and has been for centuries. And when you look at baseball, it seems like one of the reasons for that is these white folks, white baseball players and their fans could not bear the idea of equality or being defeated by a black team. And I wondered what you thought about that in general as a reason for racism, like having to actually compete against people and knowing that there's a good chance you'll lose.
Yes. I mean, all racism is built on ignorance and fear. And that fear was a very real case. And it also was an economic fear. You had African-American ballplayers who were talented. In fact, in 1887, there were, I believe, 14 players playing in the International Association. That was the league that he had broken into, you know, many years before, you know, about 10 years before. And they were the leading pitcher. They were the leading hitter. He was batting 350, the highest he had ever batted in his life. There was a young player from Memphis, Will Renfro, that he brought along with him. And what happened in 1887 really was a very significant factor, and Bud Fowler was at the heart of the establishment of what was called the color line and the gentleman's agreement. In 1887, he was playing for the Binghamton Bingos. They also had another name, the Crickets. You know, they didn't quite get the nicknames, you know, correctly, right. You know, as the, you know, threatening force. But the Bingos Crickets were playing, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the season, he's having the best season he's ever had. He writes a letter to the public and publishes it and saying, I have an offer by the Cuban Giants. The Cuban Giants were the first professional all-black team to play for them. And the implication in the letter, which was very cleverly written, you know, it was like lawyered up almost in that sense, was that he had a better opportunity and he was sorry to leave the fans of Binghamton, but he did. 1 month later, they found out the real reason that he left. There were investigative reporters there, and they discovered that the white players on the team had threatened to boycott. And, you know, team rosters then were only about 12 or 13 players. So if you had 9 white players signing a document that they're not going to play, that meant your season was over, you know. And what happened was that when this came to light, the management fined the players $50, the white players who had done this, which was a month's salary at that particular time.
Right.
So he didn't take any nonsense with it. However, at the end of that season in 1887, the International Association said, we'll grandfather in the blacks who are remaining, but we will never sign another African-American again. It was, you know, it was not virulent racism. You know, they didn't have the racialist stereotype of, you know, the black as the, you know, violent thug or the, you know, ignorant child.
Although there was a lot of that.
Oh, there was.
You quoted in your book.
There absolutely was a lot of that. But the situation also, which made it a little bit more complex for me, was that it was an economic situation. It was this fear that these African-American players are better than we are, you know, or at least are equal, and they might work for fewer dollars. So anyway, in 1887, at the end, the International Association said, well, we're not going to sign any more African-Americans. And then the two major leagues of the time, the American Association and the National League, said, great, we won't either. So what you have then is a glass ceiling, meaning that in baseball, it's not like you go directly from college into sports as you do today. You work yourself up through the minor leagues. And so since there was a glass ceiling at the highest level of the minor leagues and the major leagues, there was no incentive, you know, for blacks to play. Now, at the end of the season, this was referred to as the gentleman's agreement. And as Bud Fowler points out many times after the fact, that nothing was ever written. Anyone could have signed an African-American player at any time, you know, after this 1887 gentleman's agreement. But no one had the courage to do so until Branch Rickey did it in 1946, and Bud Fowler goes and plays in Montreal for a year before playing for Brooklyn.
We're talking to Jeff Lang about his book, Bud Fowler, Baseball's First Black Professional. Now, Bud Fowler played in New Mexico, and he also opened a barber shop in the plaza.
You're absolutely
correct.
Here
in Santa Fe.
Yes.
I love that.
Well, Bud Fowler came from a family of barbers, which was a very important African-American avenue into the middle class. You know, and the barbershop to this day, along with churches, are important social meeting places for African-Americans. Well, what Fowler did was he was playing in 1888 in the Midwest, and he had a couple of, you know, right after the Binghamton experience where, you know, he was essentially shuttled out indirectly, he goes to Indiana, and in Indiana they said, oh, you're a black man, meaning that they had signed him sight unseen, and he got out there, and they refused to honor his contract, so, you know, he wound up again looking for a place to play, you know, a smaller town played
him. Can I just interject?
Yes.
Racism in baseball was every bit as bad in the North as it was in the South, is what
right.
It looks like from your book.
Yes. You know, it was, and it was a sort of institutionalized racism that people could at one moment say, this man is a wonderful man, as they did about Bud Fowler. He's a great team player and whatever. And then they would use a racial epithet, you know, any number of creative ones as well, that would call attention to his color. So, yes, I mean, that was a problem. So he's in Indiana, and he plays for an opposing team. He does very, very well. The team folds financially. He's looking for a job in early July. Now, he had played out here in the West in 1885 with Pueblo. There was a small league called the Colorado State League that again was built on the railroad that had Pueblo, Denver, and Leadville. So he plays there for a while, and so he was known in the West. He actually spent a winter in the West as a runner, as a competitive runner to keep in shape, and a competitive walker. So not only did you have that, you know, sense of the West, you know, Santa Fe at the time was in the middle of a pennant race, and Albuquerque and Las Vegas, the other two teams, were signing ringers, you know, throughout the rest of the country and bringing them in. You know, the New Mexico Baseball League, as far as I could tell, had no players from New Mexico. You know, they were all outside, and the whole idea was this sort of civic competition. He gets out here, and I think the final straw was his first set of games was in Las Vegas. So he takes the train with the team out, and they go to have dinner at the Plaza Hotel, the one that's in existence today. They walk in the front door of the Plaza Hotel, and they say, well, this man can't sit at the community table. And he gives a blistering interview to the Santa Fe Daily Herald, to a reporter, that says, you know, enough is enough. And he had felt that, you know, it was time that something be done. And at the end of the season, towards the end of the season, he bought into a barber shop. There was an opportunity. There on the plaza, there was a hotel called the Capitol Hotel. And right next to it was a little hole-in-the-wall barbershop called the Capitol Hotel. And it was run by an Anglo. And he went in as a partner with this Anglo. I think Barber Haskins was his name. And they had a little shop. I think it was kind of where Dressman's souvenir shop was, right next to the First Interstate Plaza. It was in that particular area there. And so he was all set to spend his time here. Well, what happened in the winter was financial problems. The league folded, you know. He was planning on going on an all-star team of the New Mexico Baseball League out to San Bernardino. I found out that he was in San Bernardino, but he was playing for black teams. The team never made it out. And so, you know, Santa Fe had its one moment in the sun. You know, it won the championship, but the other teams folded. And so Santa Fe obviously had no competition, so the league ended. And so what he did was, instead of coming back to his barbershop and playing in 1889 here, he went back to the Midwest where there were greater opportunities.
Jeff Lang is author of the new book, Bud Fowler, Baseball's First Black Professional. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, tomorrow at 6 o'clock in the evening here in Santa Fe. And he will also be speaking on Tuesday, October 8th at the Santa Fe chapter of the NAACP at 7 o'clock at St. Bede's Church on San Mateo. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It was an opportunity to talk about something that I could talk about endlessly.
I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.